Hello everyone, my name's Si Biggs and I'd like to welcome you to the Royal Marines Geohistory Podcast, the aim of which is to capture some oral history of former Royal Marines and support my wider project of mapping Royal Marines history since 1664. Today in the first ever podcast, I'm delighted to be able to talk to Ron Knight. Ron was really the inspiration for me to kickstart this series of podcasts. Quickly became evident from my first phone call with Ron, he had so many interesting bits to tell that I'd never be able to write them all down quickly enough with the standard issue one finger typing, or be able to capture all of his amazing stories with enough brevity. So I thought maybe an oral presentation and a podcast in particular would be a good medium to tell a few stories. I hope you'll be able to tune in and listen in your car, on your bike at work, or in the back of a Herc with your bag ration, and be inspired by the stories of guys that experienced life in the Royal Marines and in other services in a different era, and in many cases, histories that really are lost to us in any detail. So please enjoy listening to Ron, and please forgive my interruptions, which are in most cases surplus to requirement, as he takes us through his personal and, I believe, truly inspiring life story. So welcome, Ron, to the pod. This is the first, and you were the inspiration for me doing it. Talking to you the other day, such a lovely conversation, hearing about your history and your time in the Royal Marines and after as well, really inspired me to start this podcast. So I hope that those people that will listen to it will enjoy it, enjoy listening to you and the stories you've got to tell. So welcome. What I'd like to do, Ron, is really start. You joined when you were 17 years old in 1948, but I think it's always interesting to know a little bit of background about someone, you know. So I just wondered if you could tell me sort of a bit about yourself, where you were born, a little bit about your family and your upbringing before you joined up.
Yeah, sure. Yep. I was born on Christmas Day in 1930. Eventually went to school, of course, age five, and I left school at 14. I did not obtain any formal qualifications. But during that time, the war was on all the time I was at school. And I can recollect spending most of the time, or a lot of the time, certainly, in the air raid shelters. And then the school got damaged and we were closed for 6 months. Then we got back to school again and then it was closed to be taken over as a barracks for 3 more months for the army. So my schooling was very, very little.
Oh, right.
But I eventually left school at 14 and I joined the railway. I joined the LNER as a cleaner. My ambition then was to drive the Flying Scotsman one day.
Oh, yeah, right, I then really? Became a yeah, fireman amazing.
And I thoroughly enjoyed working on the steam. But when I got to 17 and a half, national service was invoked then and was looming over me. And one thing I didn't want to do was to end up as a Bevan boy and going down the mines. So, yeah, I went along to White City, to the recruitment centre, and I joined the Marines. I chose them because at this time I was deciding to join up and beat the national service by selecting my type of unit and service, and I saw a poster, a colourful poster of a Royal Marine in full uniform, and the wording said "See the world." So that was me. So I went along to the recruiting centre, and I said, "Yeah, you've done the right thing, lad. But you've got to sign on for a minimum of 7 years with five colours."
Mm.
But I was so keen to avoid national service. Randomly sending me anywhere, I signed on for the 7 and joined the Marines and joined the deal in September 1948. It was the year actually that we had the Olympics
Amazing,
in this country
yeah.
again at that time. I remember it. So I joined the deal in 1948. After 13 weeks at deal, we moved to Eastney where we did 6 weeks naval gunnery and a week at sea service.
Yeah.
Then we went to Limpston and did another 13 weeks field training and then moved to Bickley for another 6 weeks at the commando course. And that saw my training then completed in August 1949.
Okay, yeah, amazing. Yeah. So commando training had probably only just moved a bit,
That's
did you know? Because it was
it
actually
had gone
carried during
through
the
there.
war and then it went to
That's
North
right.
Wales
Yeah.
for a
Yeah.
time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you would have been one of the first through, I guess, at Bickley at the time. Before then, of course, it then moved to Limpston where I did mine and my father did his. So oh yeah, okay, that was interesting, yeah. Because but Bickley now
Yeah.
the home of 4-2 Commando, of course. So
I haven't,
have you been
no.
back down there
I'd
at
love
all?
to actually one of these days.
I guess probably Bickley Vale and the area where you did your commando course has probably changed very
Yes.
little.
But I one of the things I found down there, I love Dartmoor. Most of my it was always raining, and most of my colleagues in the squads didn't like Dartmoor. But I like the feeling of wilderness. When my
Yeah,
married
okay,
life,
yeah.
we went on holiday to the West Country, I always insisted that the route took us over Dartmoor so that I could pick up a lump of Dartmoor granite to take home to put in my garden.
Oh,
So
really?
I was
Oh, that's
slowly
amazing. Yeah,
transporting
okay.
Dartmoor to my front garden.
Yeah, which is why there's hardly any left anymore and
Yeah.
Dartmoor on, unfortunately. Once you finished your training, then that was from Bickley. You then
Yes,
were drafted
from
from
Bickley, I
Bickley,
was
were you?
drafted back to Eastleigh for supposedly
Mm.
for a further gunnery qualification. But that never happened,
Right.
so I
Okay.
ended up
So,
on,
what did you do
sorry,
in your
just
original?
doing general duties. Although on one occasion I was sent to Browndown to do a sniper's course, but at the
Yeah.
last minute that got cancelled, and I was sent to Chatham Barracks in March 50 for 3 months, general duties,
Yes.
and it was to see oversee or be part of the closing of the Royal Marine Barracks at Chatham.
Oh,
Yeah.
okay. So that's
And
when
then
that
from
closed.
there,
Yeah,
I
I
went
see.
back to Eastleigh in July 1950. And in October 50, whilst at Eastleigh, I got the instruction to join a detachment there, which was forming for HMS Belfast.
So that would have been your sort of pre-embarkation
And so
training
there
bit. And
we.
did you do that as a whole ship's
No,
detachment,
the
or
whole
was
ship's
it?
detachment got together, and we had quite a good time there of training, drilling, and everything. So the Marines
Sorry,
on
Rob,
HMS Belfast
go ahead.
manned two of the twin 4-inch mountains, plus of course the six-inch X turret. My particular
Okay,
gunnery
yeah.
position was as a member of one of the twin 4-inch guns, P2. And we were
Okay.
always training there, all the way out, via Malta to the Far East. So by the time we got to Japan to go to Korea, we were well and truly versed in the twin 4-inch.
And what about P2? She was
Well,
that
it was
was
a
a port
portside, yeah,
side gun then, I
portside
guess,
twin
because it
4-inch.
was
Yeah, there was
P for port, was it?
P1 and P2. That's two portside twin 4-inch mountains.
How many Royal Marine crew were
There
manning
was
that 4-inch?
six.
Okay,
I
yeah. And what was your
was a loader.
job? What was
We had
your
a
role?
trainer on there who supposedly was to train the turret, and we had somebody on the laying position to time the shells. But in practice, because during that time of the life, planes were jets. They were things like MiGs and things like that, and they moved so
Hmm.
fast, coming over the
Yeah.
horizon, say just 7 miles away. There was no time to set timing fuses on guns and that. So the practice on the Belfast was the
Yeah.
guns would be located to the radar, which would actually fire the gun, and the firing system was kept closed all time in the firing position. That meant that as soon as you rammed a shell into the breach would come up and the gun would fire. So the loader, you would have to
Right.
duck down as the shell case went over your head, and then your colleague behind you would then
Right.
jump in place. So you ram the shell in with your hand, ducked because the gun went off immediately. It had
Because it
been
was being
targeted by the
targeted by the
radar.
radar.
Instead of using timed shells with timed fuses, we had what they call a proximity fuse, a VT fuse, and once that left the barrel of the ship, the first thing that got within 50 feet of it exploded.
Okay, yeah, to cause shrapnel and damage
Yeah.
to the jet.
So the main job
Very
basically on the
interesting.
trim 4-inch was a loading. The breech closed itself when the shell went in. The gun was already aimed by the radar and it fired. The gun fired as quick as the loaders could load the barrel.
Where did the ammunition come? Did it come from below?
Some lockers adjacent to the gun with an immediate supply, but there's also a mechanical conveyor, which brought up further supplies from below from the magazine.
So I guess there was a bit of competition between the guns.
But the training always included once a month, we would be timed by the gunnery officer to see how fast we could fire the guns. All the 4-inch mounted on the ship, and I'm happy to say that P2. Won it every time when I was on there, every time, and there was a £10 prize for the crew from the captain. So we had every incentive. Well,
right.
Apart from preservation, we had every incentive to be a good team, and we always won the prize. It was surprising how quickly
we could get
the gun to fire. At a surgical meeting, I met an admiral, and he was asking me, he said, "What position were you on?" On the Belfine. I explained I was a loader, and he looked down at my hand and he said, "Have you still got all your fingers?" And I did, and I showed him. Because what could often happen if you had a straight finger when you rammed the shell in, because the gun was already set to fire, the breech immediately closed, and if you've got a loose finger, that was your finger gone.
So you kept your, so you kept your fist
closed.
Sure.
No loose fingers.
And how heavy were the rounds? They were obviously quite heavy, were they?
The shell and
right, place. Okay.
When the gun was slightly elevated, of course you were pushing that slightly uphill, as it were, in through the breech into the barrel, and you needed to be
very interesting, Ron. And did you ever have to fire them in anger?
Oh yes, many times. The strange thing was that once you got the gun loaded. You couldn't hear any approaching aircraft. Then suddenly the gun would start firing, and you're immediately loading it like mad. And it seemed to be a little while after before suddenly you heard a terrific noise as a jet streaked over. It was said jets. It was the Russian MiGs that the Chinese and the Koreans were using. And with the rocket, it was estimated that one of their rockets, if it hit you, would have the penetration power of an armoured 8-inch shell.
Yes.
Yeah, so, the enemy came in over the horizon. The gun started firing before you could ever hear it. And by the time you heard it, the gun had stopped firing because the plane's gone.
And was there any successes? Did we?
We're not aware of any crashing. Who knows? Because the ship was actually firing at maximum distance. Beyond the horizon, which was only 7 miles on the ship.
And I guess part of the idea also is just to put the pilot off, isn't it? So he can't take that shot where he has to steer, fly away.
We did lose two other Marines on there. A Sergeant James.
Right.
And a Corporal, his name escapes me for a moment. Anyway, they were involved in a secretive multinational, multi-service escapade ashore. Something happened. They were on a landing craft. Something happened, and it's not to this day, it's not known what happened. But they were lost without trace.
Mm.
Whether they hit a mine or whether they were, I suppose, captured in hell, we'll never know. The only thing was that Corporal Hammer was the corporal. His cap was subsequently found floating in the sea. So we lost. Two NCOs there on a secretive mission.
So you spent a lot of time, I think, in Japan, sort of rearming.
Up and down the coast, usually mainly doing bombardments and things and so forth. But from time to time, we go back. Sometimes to Sasebo.
Yeah.
Other times, Yokosuka and Kure, also big Japanese naval bases, where we would re-ammunition the ship and have a run ashore. One
Yeah, well, that must have been interesting because obviously it was only 5 years after
Yeah,
the
that was
bomb had
one of
been
the things
dropped
that
and the end
surprised
of the
me.
war. So,
During
what was the sort
World
of
War II, leading from the press, the Japanese were seen to be, well, devils incarnate. Yet a few short years after the war, Japan is now our home port, and we're going ashore, we're run ashore, felt quite happy, and there were no problems with the Japanese whatsoever. As you say, a few short years after the
No,
war and
okay,
after the
yes,
atom
interesting.
bomb had been dropped, we were now finished. But then, of course, basically,
Yeah.
the reason we were there and United Nations, it was to prevent Japan being overrun by communism coming down Korea, and then and of course
Yeah.
that communism drive was mainly the Chinese supporting the North Korea. Also, they used Russian equipment. So
Yeah.
basically, it was the communist world against the United Nations.
Just going back to Belfast, so she was a large cruiser with a lot of history. She was hit originally by a magnetic mine just after joining the Home Fleet in 1939, and that put her out of action for about 3 years. And then she was at the Battle of North Cape, and then she fired the first sort of shots at D-Day. So there was a lot of history to the
Yeah,
vessel.
we knew about
Did you
that.
know
One of
about the
the,
ship before? Were
because
you
it broke its
excited that you
back,
were going to be joining a
the
ship?
things about the Belfast was on either side, you had a massive steel, extra coating of steel. In other words, to support its broken back.
Right.
So the
Oh,
ship's
okay. I
displaced.
see. Yeah,
Sometimes
after
it
the
was said to
mine.
be a 10,500 ton cruiser. But in actual fact, with this extra
Right.
steel coating around either side, it was considered to be
Sort of
more
belt.
than something more like
Yeah.
14,000 tons.
Yeah, because I think they thought they were going to write her off originally, and obviously
Yes.
managed to do. That's what they did then. They
They, in fact,
reinforced her.
reinforced it. Exactly. Yeah. So we felt a little bit safer that way.
I just want to talk a bit more about your time on Belfast because it's, those vessels are long. Although we could go to London and have a look around her, it must have been how many Marines were on board?
With the band, there was
Was it
approximately
international?
100 of us. And we had a total
Yeah.
crew
Okay.
of
So you've got.
850, which is a wartime
Okay.
commissioned
Yeah.
crew.
So.
Every gun and every defence position is manned.
And what was life like on board, when you were sailing out, for example, to Korea, what was life like on the mess decks? What sort of things did you get up to?
To my mind, it was crowded. I'm not a natural seaman. I prefer the open air, actually. We were a large contingent, and to my mind, it felt very cramped. We played board games and things like that whilst off duty, but in between that, whilst taking passage, it was gunnery drills and things like that.
I wouldn't imagine Belfast to have been cramped. I guess you were living in hammocks.
We slept in hammocks, yes, and 100 on a mess deck
Yeah.
is quite crowded.
Yeah, fair one. And
Crowded.
what about feeding and that? Did you live on your mess deck? Did you feed on your mess deck? Was it still the kind of the same as
The
it was
same,
through the war?
the usual thing. One member of each mess would go to the galley and collect the food for that particular mess, which roughly about 10 people.
And they would bring that back down.
One of the things, of course, on which was very good on that Belfast, as you know, traditionally, the ship's butcher assists with the distribution of the rum, the daily rum ration.
Okay.
And the next mess to us was the butcher,
Yeah.
and they had a way just when they helped to distribute the rum, there were one or two tricks of the trade: putting your
Yeah.
thumb in the top, a dent in the bottom. But he somehow would end up with some rum over. That rum then was better than money because with that you could buy up favors from the bakery and so on. So the next
Yeah, that's
mess to us
amazing.
lived very well, and as we were
Yeah.
adjacent to that particular mess, we lived next best well.
I had a very good friend who was on the Vanguard. He died last year, unfortunately. Very good friend of mine, Barry, and he said that he caught the Marines, and what they've basically done is got some tubing together, put it outside the vessel, down into one of the portholes. And as they poured the rum away and it went down the scupper, they managed for about 2 or 3 days to be able to collect what was thrown away, but then got caught. And I know that the rum was very, very important on board.
Oh, it's more important than money.
Yeah,
money
I'm
was
sure.
The best currency you could possibly. Rum was the best currency you could have on board at sea.
And what about the butcher? I guess he was a bootneck as well, was he?
It was a bootneck, yeah, exactly. Traditionally, the butcher was a Marine.
Yeah, I thought that.
On the big ship.
Yeah, one of the pictures you sent me was some prisoners of war on Belfast deck being guarded by some Royal Marines.
Some Chinese prisoners who had been captured, and they were actually being taken back for questioning. But as you can see, they've been paraded on the quarter deck and being well guarded.
Yeah, I saw that. And where were they captured? They were captured ashore. Or they were captured in a raid,
ashore, and we were taking them back to Japan.
Ah, okay, I see. Oh, right, to be interrogated in Japan.
Yeah, so we were providing passage.
Oh, right,
we were providing passage, you might say, for them.
Yeah, okay, very interesting. Yeah, okay, and I guess you were. Patrolling up and down the coast, you know, you were involved in quite a lot of bombardments. Were you involved in Incheon?
Yes, Incheon was one that was always being bombarded. One of the things I noticed, if our American ships were anywhere near us and they bombarded a target which they could see ashore, they seemed to fire broadsides straight away, and the whole coastline would erupt in smoke. And
really?
Everything. But once it had cleared, quite often you could still see the target there.
I see. Yeah, okay.
We on the Belfast, and I think it's typical Royal Navy, they would delegate one 6-inch gun to fire an opening round.
Right.
To range. Once they were satisfied they've got the range, then we would fire a broadside.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So you'd mark the target first,
fire on the shore away of hitting the target.
Yeah. Sure. I see that there was an American admiral that said, I think you fired some like 350 rounds, 6-inch, and it was so accurate. He said that Belfast was a straight shooting ship.
Yes, and for that reason, I think we applied really old, tried and tested means of ranging. And then firing your heaviest salvo. But sometimes you could see the targets actually on the shore because in the cold, rarefied air there, you could see a long, long way. Especially if you was doing duty on the bridge as a lookout, which we did from time to time.
Right.
You know, with powerful glasses, you could see a lot more. But sometimes the targets were invisible. They were maybe busy crossroads way inland, and the army were calling down from time to time fire at a particular point at a particular crossroads, which was being overrun.
Yeah, I see.
So sometimes it was invisible to us.
Yeah, yeah, sure, yeah, yeah. I mean, that's.
I like to think, but I'm quite sure in my own mind, our fire really was very accurate, as you say.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it was. Yeah, I think you fired over 8,000 rounds from the 6 inches during Korea. From Belfast alone.
Yep.
So, I mean, that's a lot of rounds.
A lot of ammunition. And
I've
subsequently, I saw something about the British Legion, I think, was it, but they estimated that the Chinese losses in Korea was 1.5 million.
Just unbelievable, wasn't it? Yeah. Just throwing people into the Minsa.
It says a lot for the ordnance that was lobbed over.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's incredible. I think you obviously, you know, that sort of in that coastal environment, in that amphibious littoral, you know, you obviously made a huge difference because there was a lot of amphibious warfare raids and amphibious landings. I'm sure you were involved in most of that sort of that part of the theatre. You were then drafted to 4-5 commando after Belfast. And
actually,
was that by choice?
One day we were back in Sasebo actually for a weekend in a reammunition ship, and we were getting ready for for the church service on board on a Sunday morning, and suddenly we got a message that Typhoon Ruth, I'll always remember the name, which was coming up the South China Seas, had suddenly veered towards Japan, where we were. All ships in harbour, including Belfast, were ordered to immediately put to sea, and then once we got clear of the harbour, to fan out, and then in lines ahead, to head out straight towards the oncoming typhoon.
Oh, right.
Because large ships, warships, can't afford to be caught in a harbour in a typhoon.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So head into it.
The best way of tackling the typhoon was to head straight towards it.
Right, okay.
We did that, and it was the most horrendous seas I've seen. We subsequently did suffer some damage to our propellers during that storm. Also, one of the problems we had on board, because the ship was rolling and pitching to such a degree, there was a tannoy message put over by the captain to say that some shells in the shell room had broken loose from their racks and were now banging about the shell room, loose, from side to side.
Really?
Yeah.
As you know, that's outrageous.
The shell normally is not armed until it is rotated as it comes out of the gun barrel.
Oh, I see, yeah. So it could have armed the shells. No,
but there's still a big risk with these shells banging about that somehow one would arm itself, and then that would be the ship up.
Yeah.
And they overcome the problem in the end by throwing hammocks. You couldn't go down there because a 100-weight shell banging one side of the ship and suddenly going would crush you. So they actually, in the end, threw down loads and loads of hammocks.
Oh, okay, yeah.
It bound the situation up and saved the
life. Yeah, right.
But as
yeah, amazing.
As a result of that damage, we were sent for 3 months down to Singapore.
Yeah.
To have a refit, and we went into battle.
Ah, okay.
For 3 months.
Oh, really?
We had new gun barrels, and we had all sorts of work done. New gun barrels. The rudder was fixed, and we had three nice months in barracks. And it was while I was in barracks that in the canteen one day, I was having a pint in the naval barracks, and there were some Marines there from 4-5 Commando.
Right.
And talking to one of them on the table, he said, "Blimey, I wish, my next drummer," he said, "why the heck couldn't I have gone on a ship? I'd love to have gone on a ship." So I said, "Well, right. I'm on a ship, and my preference is for land warfare." So he said, "Why don't we arrange to do a swap?"
Oh, really?
So we each eventually went back to our respective commanders, and it all took several months. But one day, back in Japan, where we returned, I suddenly got a message, "Marine Knight, get your kit bag quick, because your relief has arrived. No. You are due to catch a destroyer down to Singapore that's about to leave."
That's amazing.
So
yeah.
I had to rush to get all my gear together, be transported to this destroyer, took passage down to Singapore, naval barracks. Next day, we put on a train at Johor Bahru, and then went up to Ipoh, where I joined 4-5 Commando.
And that's where they were operating that was their sort of training base?
Yeah, but my particular troop was actually based about 9 miles away from Ipoh, a place called Batagaja, and we lived in tents.
Right. And that was a patrol base, was it, that you were patrolling from?
That was our patrol base. And from there, the job was to go out and into the jungle, so several days, sometimes a couple of weeks at a time, just looking and following and trying to find a communist hideout. It's ironic, of course, as you may know. We armed and trained a lot of those Chinese leaders in Malaya to fight the Japanese from within the Malayan jungle.
Yeah.
But when World War II was over, these same Chinese then decided that Malaya, as we then knew it, was a very rich in resources, minerals, rubber, etc., and they wanted to take it over. So They tried to take the country over. So we ended up really fighting people who we'd armed and trained.
You'd already trained, yeah, of course, yeah. And what about your training? Did you do some jungle training before you deployed?
I went straight into the jungle. You learnt as you went along. My particular...
on the job training.
My particular job was each patrol had a mixture of weapons. Mine was a Bren gun and a pistol. Two of us used to carry Bren guns, strapped around your neck. We'd also carry a couple of grenades each. We had some of the chaps had the old-fashioned rifles with cup discharges so they could lob grenades. Somebody with a Sten gun, which with a silencer. Others were armed with the short British rifle with the anti-flash attachment. Yeah. And some of the others had American carbines. So actually, one of our patrols was really a multi...
real mix.
A remit of different weapons. We also used to have with us a couple of trackers called E-bands from Borneo. But I found trackers, in time that our chaps became just as good at tracking as them. Like, you know, we learnt the ropes.
Why such a weapons mix?
Well, because in the jungle, you haven't got to look. It's not like being on a range where you can, you know, sight. In the jungle, nothing happened. Or when it did, it meant you were caught in an ambush.
So you needed different weapon systems depending on the situation.
You needed a massive, quick response, fire-wise.
Yeah.
Because
I see, yeah. Okay.
An ambush type war. You either ambushed them or they ambushed you. Simple as that.
Yeah. And where did that ambushing happen? That was tracks and rivers and streams, I suppose, mostly.
Yeah. Yeah. All mixed. Some of it quite dense jungle. Some of the others a bit more scattered. But one of the good things about that, we were supplied by air. Very small parachutes. They weren't big ones, so they were almost aimed at a small clearing, where they were sending our supplies, ammunition and boots and things, medication. But also the supplies included our rum ration.
Right, now, of course.
The rum was given to carry to the sergeant of each of the section.
Yeah,
and he was the safest man in the section because he couldn't move without eyes watching him.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But each day we would have a small tot of rum.
It's incredible in the jungle in Malaya. That's
even
amazing.
Malaya, we had our rum, and by golly, did we look forward to it? We were soaking wet. It seemed to rain every day. About 5 o'clock each day. It'd be a total deluge. Yeah. And then shortly after, it'd suddenly get dark, by which time you've got to make yourself a little basher for the night with a sentry, of course. That's where the two Bren gunners came in. One would sight his weapon down track and the other one would sight his up track. So if during the night anything moved, you fired.
Yeah, you just fired into the jungle.
And all firing was so instant.
Yeah.
We all, on our hats, we used to wear a white cross to try to recognise friends, as it were. But they always made certain that units always worked very widely scattered to avoid the risk of meeting up. Because with ambushing in jungle, the finger was on the trigger and...
You couldn't make any mistakes.
Nighttime, I found very quiet. What I felt at dawn, then the jungle seemed to be alive with animal noises.
Right.
Apes and all sorts of things, you know. And maybe one heck of a din, extremely loud. Because it's a new day, I guess.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, everyone's getting up at the same time, including the Marines. Yeah.
We lived on small ration packs, and for water, we just used swamp water.
What do you remember of the rations?
The rations were the small sealed ration pack, 24-hour ration packs, a tin of meat, a tin of fish, maybe a bit of chocolate, a few sweets.
Yeah.
And I was a vegetarian, actually, so I never ate meat or fish. So I used to swap my my meat and fish and that type of thing for other people's chocolate sweets.
Yeah, of course, chocolate and rum.
Yeah.
And can you tell us any stories? Do you remember any specific incidents, you know, that happened when you were in the jungle?
No, all I remember is the weather, the daily grind, constantly being soaking wet, being eaten to death by mosquitoes. Yeah. Oh, and there was one thing that did upset us a little bit. From time to time, Sunderland flying boats, manned by the RAF, would fly across patches of jungle and then drop a string of bombs. The idea was to demoralise the communists, bandits in the jungle. But of course, the bombs would have known the difference between a communist bandit and us, because if we were following some closely and trying to, you know, catch up with them, we could have caught the bombs. I subsequently, not many years ago, I was at a meeting of a local society I'm in, and the guest speaker was an ex-wing commander in the RAF, and his story was about the job that they did in Malaya, demoralising the communist bandits by bombing them. At the end of his talk, he said, "Are there any questions?" So I stood up and I said, "I've got no questions, but I've got a comment to make." I said, "You terrified us down there because you were dropping bombs anywhere, and we were there as well."
Yeah.
And with that, he shut up. Like, that was the end of the thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure he did.
No,
that was interesting. Sunderland's. Did they have the bombs on the side, or they just throw them out the doors? Probably. So Malaya, you were there really, really at the sort of the height of the insurrection and the you know, in our sort of period there, weren't you? Before it changed, you were telling me something about your medal as well, and the way it's minted.
Oh yeah, the Naval General Service Medal, which was appropriate for Korea, also had a clasp, a bar, and it. On it is Malaya, which was, of course, the name of that theatre then. And, of course, in due course, when the campaign successfully ended and the country was eventually handed back to the locals, they renamed it Malaysia. So it's, my campaign medal for Malaya does have a Malaya bar on it.
So from there, Ron, how did that sort of end for you? How did 4-5 Commando finish? Did you leave with 4-5?
In December 1952, the 4-5 moved from our tour of duty in Malaya, and we moved to Malta.
Oh, okay.
For going back to our traditional commando role, you know, cliff climbing and beach assaults and things like that. We went by troop ship to Malta.
Right.
And I was
4-5 was based in Malta then.
And I was based in Malta in St. Andrew's Barracks. We were distributed around the island, but I was in particular at St. Andrew's Barracks. Whilst I was there at St. Andrew's Barracks and we were doing our traditional training and things, I suddenly banged my ankle one day and I made a big sore place on it. And it didn't seem to heal. So after a week, I went and saw the first aid people and they treated it and said, "Come back in a few days' time." I went back in a few days' time and it was no better. So they said, "You will have to go into hospital." So I was transferred to Imtapa, the military hospital in Malta.
Malta.
And apparently my diet in Malaya had got me to a state where I was extremely anemic. Although in Malaya I could carry me, do my job and carry a gun around, etc., etc., my blood was anemic, but it wouldn't heal. So I actually spent 3 months in the military hospital in Malta. And one of the things they gave me to help my diet quickly improve was diluted hydrochloric acid. diluted. The idea of that was it would break down food more quickly.
I see. Yeah.
So I had 3 months in the military hospital there. One interesting thing that was, every so often, once every couple of months, all the different service doctors on the island would meet for a conference. And one day, the naval lieutenant who was treating me, naval surgeon, he said, "It's my turn to give the talk next week."
Yeah.
And he said, "I'd like to make you my subject." He said, horror on my face, he said, "Don't worry." He said, all you've got to do is sit on a chair, on a stage. You'll see a lot of faces, but he said, "I'll do all the talking." So the day duly arrived, and he gave really my history in Malaya, what I had to live on, what I you know, the duties I carried out, etc., etc., etc. And it was only when I banged my leg and it wouldn't heal that the problem came to light.
I see. But
his basic theme was, at the end of the day, was, we used to be surprised that the Japanese, with a bag full of rice, could go out in the jungle and fight for days or weeks on end with hardly any other support by way of nourishment. But he said, this man has literally done that in another way. He said, do we therefore need to give our... Do we need, therefore, to supply our frontline troops with such luxurious ration packs? It could be a lot more basic than we actually give them, and they can still function.
Survive. Function, yeah.
So he actually invited me to a Japanese who went out with his bag of rice and then and survived. That was his whole thing, but that took about an hour to record all that. But apparently it went down well.
Oh, really? So I guess if there's guys in the jungle now that are on rice and not any meat, they can
thank you. Exactly. To what extent, in due course, his serious recommendation was that they seriously considered what went in a ration pack as being necessary.
Yeah.
As opposed to luxury.
Yeah, well, it's all weight.
Yeah,
it's all weight at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And a supply problem. Yeah. So okay. That's interesting, Ron. So so once you come out of hospital, what happened then?
So then I was eventually on the 25th of December 52, I was then flown home from Malta to the UK on what they call a CASAVAC. RAF planes coming as far away from the Far East and picking up servicemen being returned for medical reasons to the UK.
So I came
on that and flew into RAF Rorton and then transferred to Plymouth Barracks. I was at Plymouth Barracks for a few weeks and then was drafted to HMS Victory.
Yes, amazing.
I remember going by train to Portsmouth, and canvas covered lorry picked up myself and some other sailors, and then it went into the dockyard. And as it got to certain places in the dockyard, the driver would shout out HMS this or HMS that.
Yeah.
In due course, it stopped and it shouted out, the driver shouted out, "Okay, Royal, it's the Victory." I fully expected to see something like an aircraft carrier. But when I got down from the vehicle, it was HMS Victory, Nelson's flagship.
That's incredible.
I could not believe it.
Hey, so you didn't realise until that point?
I did not realise to that point that Victory, because there is an HMS Victory Barracks, you know, as well.
Okay, oh, right.
So people could say I was on the Victory at Portsmouth, but they are referring to the naval barracks.
Ah, I see.
Yeah,
Yeah.
well,
Yeah. So you didn't realise you were going on the ship.
they used to define that by saying HMS Victory brackets ship.
Yeah. Okay. I see. Yeah. Right.
That was the
And that.
most interesting and fascinating job imaginable. So I spent over almost 2.5 years there on board HMS Victory. Basically, we acted as guides to the general public, but also,
Yeah.
as we become more and more acquainted with the details of Trafalgar and the ship, I found myself getting more specialised groups of people, like groups of visiting officers and things like that, or visiting dignitaries from royalty from abroad. On one occasion, I recollect the Queen there visiting on the Royal Yacht Britannia. She came in the harbour and she brought a party on board.
Oh, really? Yeah, okay.
Also while I was on there, the BBC would come and make recordings of rolling out a cannon or to record the sound of the wind in the ship's rigging.
Oh, right, for
You
their
know,
archives.
and some of the scenes from Bligh and the Bounty were taken there.
Right, okay. Oh, so you saw that,
Yeah,
yeah.
so it was a most interesting ship, and I met some very interesting people. Also on there, of course,
Yeah.
we also got our rum ration.
Okay. Yeah, because you were on a ship,
It's,
on a
it,
ship
yeah,
still flying the White
yeah,
Ensign.
it was. It's still a commissioned ship, because
Yeah.
it's Commander-in-Chief's flagship. All court marshals were held on board, and any visiting
Right.
dignitaries who came to Portsmouth, national or whatever, they would be entertained on the Victory in Nelson's cabin.
Cabin,
Yeah, so
yeah. Yeah, it's
it was a
amazing, yeah.
scene of you see a lot of people. I do recollect while I was on there, we had two Russian leaders came over to visit this country, and they were anchored nearby on a jetty nearby, and the two I've forgotten their names now, but they were joint leaders at that time of the Russian, and they came over on a ship on a goodwill tour. Now, I think what happened, somebody wisely realized that if two leaders were coming this country on a ship, it would be the most up-to-date ship in the Russian Navy.
Yeah.
So it anchored next to us on a jetty, because we were in dry, Victory was in dry dock. And these two leaders came on board, were entertained by the commander in chief. Whilst they were on board, as we now know, Buster Crabbe, the frogman,
Yeah.
entered the harbour at the mouth of Portsmouth Harbour, swam underneath this cruiser to check what sort of anti-submarine and so on equipment he got. He was detected, and as you know, he disappeared. And to
Yeah,
this day,
sure.
it's not known whether he was subsequently killed or taken back to Russia to be questioned.
Yeah, no,
I always
that.
thought they wouldn't murder him. I always thought they would take him back to Russia and find out what they could. But no, the two
Yeah.
Russian leaders were on board. I was on board HMS Victory where they were. We were not aware of any fuss whatsoever. It was only after the Russian leaders had left, the ship had left, then it gradually emerged what happened.
Yeah, okay, I know the story reasonably well. It was Nikita Khrushchev and Bulganin,
I
is
think
it Bulganin?
that name
Someone like
rang a
that was
bell with
the
me.
two
Yeah,
leaders.
both of them came home.
Very interesting, mate, that you were there in that period. That's amazing. So what and so then what else were you doing on board? So you were living on board,
We
were
lived
you?
on
So you were
board.
in
We
hammocks, I
slept in
guess.
hammocks, and our food was cooked in a small building on the adjacent on the jetty side, where we had a retired naval
Right.
chef who cooked our meals. They
Oh,
were taken
okay.
on board in
Yeah.
trays. We had our own little mess deck. There was just one part of the ship where visitors couldn't and didn't go, and it was where we slept in
Yeah.
hammocks, and we had mess tables, and we lived.
I guess you were in full blues most of the time doing the tours.
Yes, and
Yeah.
Every Trafalgar Day, 21st of October, the commander-in-chief would lay a wreath on the spot where Nelson fell on the quarter deck. And the 2 years I was on there, I was given the assignment to hand the wreath to the commander-in-chief to place reverently on the deck where Nelson fell.
Yeah, I've got a fantastic picture you sent to me in your pith helmet and your blues and your medals holding a wreath. I'll put that on the website as well so people can see it. But yeah, that must have been something special, actually, you know, to be able to be part of that.
Yeah.
And you're also telling me a really interesting story about the numbers.
Yes, I always found it slightly strange and unusual. I knew that the crew on the HMS Belfast, wartime crew, was some 850 heads personnel. At Trafalgar, the head count on HMS Victory was also 850. I thought that a strange coincidence. But I also remember HMS Victory was much smaller than the Belfast. Also, it also had live animals on board for food, things like pigs.
I could not
imagine what it must have been like to have lived on board in the days of Trafalgar. And of course, like at Trafalgar, when the ships went to war, a cannonball at a mile distance was said it could force its way through a foot thick of oak timber. But the amount of splinters that must have been showered through on anybody the other side, it must have been horrendous. What the sailors and people suffered in those days, it must have been horrendous.
Oh yeah, yeah. I think the injuries on board, you know, from you're right, from the splinters and things were unbelievable. I mean, look at Nelson dying. Really, you know, it was a wound that, you know, that might not have killed him today. You know, it's just that's what they died from, wasn't it? And if they didn't die from the actual shock of it, you know, they would die from the wounds and the infection after. So yeah, it was horrendous.
But without drugs and painkillers, the poor souls must have suffered horrendously, mustn't they?
We had quite a commitment at Trafalgar, obviously sharpshooters and officers on deck. And boarding parties. 17 officers and 332 Marines were killed or wounded at Trafalgar.
Unfortunately, Lord Nelson wore his very colourful uniform and he would have been very conspicuous on his ship. But one of the things I admired, I always thought he was a good man manager, because apparently leading up to Trafalgar, he would in turn invite the captains of the ships in his fleet to come and dine on board the Victory. And during that meal, he would tell them exactly what he intended to do and the way he intended the battle to go. That meant that when the captains went back to their respective ships, and whatever happened during the battle, they will have known what the intention was and what the plan was. I think so often nowadays, the troops don't really know what the plan is. But Nelson made certain all his captains knew what the plan was.
Yeah, no, definitely, and gave them that sort of mission command, the ability to be able to make their own decisions.
Basically, it was to hit the French and Spanish lines in two places, one column led by Collingwood, one led by Nelson. As they went under the stern, as they went through the rows and went under the stern, we was able to fire broadsides down the length of the ships. If you look at the casualty rate at Trafalgar, the French and Spanish lost so many killed and dead compared to us. And it's no wonder, because of our tactic of firing broadsides down the length of the ship. Because
split them as well, didn't it? Split their fleet.
Of course, the Spanish and Spanish were in a double line coming to those ships. Initially, were coming towards ships in line who also could fire broadsides, but their gunnery is nowhere as good as the British gunnery. Although they did some damage to the approaching British fleet, they never did anything that was absolutely, you know, kill blow. Thus, the ships got to them, then sailed through them at two points, in turn firing broadsides down the length of the ship, and then, of course, getting engaged alongside. So We cause horrendous casualties by doing that.
That's very interesting, yeah. Then you left the Royal Marines
from Victory.
From
I left
Victory.
The Royal Marines in December 1955. I left and joined the Metropolitan Police. But
okay.
After a couple of years, the Metropolitan Police is I recruited a nurse, and we lived in Essex. It was buying our own house when I came out of the Marines. The police suited me fine. The only trouble was our house was outside the Metropolitan Police District's boundary. And in those days, they were insistent that as many officers as possible lived within the police boundary. So I was pressured to move
and
eventually decided I would leave the police because they would never leave me alone. Although I enjoyed the job in those days, I think you had a lot more power, a lot more respect from the public. So I then joined an interim job for Lloyds Bank on their security.
Yes.
One of the jobs I had with them, actually, was a temporary job down at Durrington. They had a branch at Durrington near Worthing where the local security man had left and they wanted somebody to do the job. I went down there travelling daily from Essex for several weeks. And during that time, the branch manager said, look, I can make sure you'll get a good deal. If you like to take this job on permanently, I'll see you get a certain amount of allowances from the bank for this and that. But I was happy in Essex where we got our house. My wife had a job. My children were going to school. So I decided I didn't want to take it on permanently. He eventually found somebody to take the job on. I trained the chap up. And after a couple of weeks, said, well, on a Friday night, well, goodbye. I hope you get on well with the job. That next Monday, the place was attacked by armed robbers and he was murdered. And the two robbers were eventually caught and hung for his murder. So I missed a certain one there by a weekend.
By a whisker. Yeah, unbelievable.
After 5 years with the Lloyds Bank, I had an opportunity to join Ford Motor Company security as a security man. The pay was very good, and what's more, they didn't mind where you lived, provided you on duty at the required time. You could live where you like, so that suited me well, and I got on very well there, and eventually attained a management role rank. Whilst I was there, I suddenly got a desire to get fit again, like I had been in the Marines. So I took up running.
Yeah.
And that became eventually from half a mile a day to marathon running. And in the end, ran 13 marathons. 18 were at London, including the first running of the London Marathon.
Oh, right. You were in the first one. I think you said it was 38 marathons you said you did.
I went to places like Berlin during the occupation there, but ran 38 marathons. At the same time, I was very keen on marching. And I'd always heard about the four-day international marches in Holland at Nijmegen. And I went a few times of my own, 5 years actually. But then as I got more promotion and I became a manager, the buzzword went down one day. Team building. And I had an immediate thought. I asked my boss, could he get approval for me to take a team of security men from Dagenham, where we were based, to participate in these marches, take the company flag, take the Union Jack and a company uniform. Yeah. That was put all the way up to the Vice President Finance. Because he liked the idea and it was the appropriate time, message came back with approval on a piece of paper that I could take a team of 30 guards and supervisors to Nijmegen for a week. They would be on pay and their replacements would be on pay on overtime in their absence. We also had company vehicles and they sent two nurses with us from the company medical department. So it was quite an expensive trip. It was very successful. We did very well and gave a good show of ourselves. But I took the trouble to photocopy the vice president's financial approval. Every year thereafter, whilst I was a manager at Dagenham, put in 8 years.
I hope you waterproofed it as well.
To Nijmegen, and in the end, it went 28 times, getting the gold medal in the end. But it was team
that's
building.
Amazing.
But bear in mind, most of our security personnel were either ex-policemen or ex-servicemen. That they thoroughly enjoyed it. It was quite a challenge, and we got on very well over there with the Rotterdam police. We used to be based with the Rotterdam police in particular, and we got on very well. So I enjoyed
amazing.
That.
And you
in due course I retired, and I still carried on my running. And one day I went out to some training. I'd only gone half a mile, and I suddenly got out of breath. And I had to walk for a few hundred yards, and then I started to run a little bit again. But I thought, God, what happened? This is not me, right? I'm now used to running. You know your body. I went out the next day, and the same thing happened. That worried me. So I went and saw my GP, and he said, Mr. Knight, what's the matter? So I said, well, when I go running, doctor, I get out of breath. He looked at me over his glasses, and he said, how old are you now, Mr. Knight? I said, I'm 67. He said, if you go running, man, at 67, of course you get out of breath. Doctor, this is not me. This is not me. This is not me. He shut me up in the end. He said, oh, well, we'll send you for a blood test. He did that, and it came back that I was suddenly extremely anemic. That's why I was getting out of breath suddenly.
Right.
I wasn't uptaking the oxygen.
Yeah.
So why was I anemic? They did an endoscopy where you look inside with a camera, and the surgeon said,
yeah.
Sorry, you've got stomach cancer. Now, I had no other pains, no aches. The only indication I had of stomach cancer was the fact that when I went running at age 67, unusual for me, I was getting out of breath. So within 2 weeks, I was in hospital and I had a complete gastrectomy. That's complete removal of your stomach. And then you live on small amounts of food. More often, and your intestines basically becomes your stomach. 18 months later, I was back to me running and back to running more London Marathon.
More marathon. So, incredible, Ron. Absolutely incredible.
My running saved my life. There was one other incident I remember where I had two others actually. There was the incident where I just missed the death at Durrington when I worked for Lloyds Bank. But whilst I was at school during the war, we had the school suddenly received a letter from the Canadian government offering to have children from the school as evacuees. And we all had a letter to take home. I remember taking mine home and saying to my parents, I want to go. All I could think of was the Wild West and excitement. My parents said, no, we will stay together through thick and thin. As it happened, all the other parents of the children at school at that time with the same offer, all declined, excepting one set of parents whose lone son I used to play with. They signed for him to go. I well remember still playing with him. He had a red piece of ribbon around his arm when he had his injections. And then, of course, he went. The ship he went on was torpedoed. And quite a few hundred children, evacuees intended, died. Had my parents allowed me to go, I would have been below the North Atlantic. It was kept very quiet at the time.
Yeah.
On top of my memory, there were something like 1,300 children on board. I don't think the submarine commander knew
that
exactly it was loaded with children, but I mean, to him, it was a cruise ship coming out of Liverpool.
Oh,
so
I didn't know that story. That's terrible.
I was extremely fortunate there. I was extremely fortunate at Durrington. I was extremely fortunate in my running, which told me that I'd got stomach cancer, although the doctor said I hadn't got any problems. And I'm still living to fight another day. I keep myself busy. I've lost my wife, so I live alone. But prior to COVID, I worked for the West Summit Hospital as a volunteer for 10 years in the eye treatment centre where they inject people's eyes for macular degeneration. need a lot of support for that because it's not a nice thought having a needle put into your eye. Come COVID, all that stopped and has stopped till now. So to keep myself occupied now and interested, I'm working 3 days a week at a local vaccine hub, helping to steward people Center. Having their vaccines. Yeah. So that's rewarding. So I still feel I've got a quality of life because I feel I'm achieving something. I'm contributing. I'm doing something. I'm still part of a team, et cetera, et cetera.
You certainly
so
are.
So my Marine training, being part of a team, once a Marine, always a Marine, and never give up, you know, nothing's impossible. I still feel the same. I'm 90 years old now, so I think I'm much older than anybody else there getting their vaccine.
Hopefully I'm getting mine next week. I wish you were there to, as I came through, that'd be fantastic. You certainly haven't rested on your laurels, and that, you know, that commando spirit's definitely there with you.
Lucky. I had my first injection of a vaccine on 17th of December and the second one on the 7th of January.
Yeah.
By virtue of age, I was called up quite early for the doctor's surgery, so I had both mine quite early. But one of the things I notice now, the people turning up, vaccination centre, they are all very appreciative of the thought. Many of them are always saying thanks for what you're doing and everything, and everyone seems absolutely relieved and even excited that they are getting their first jab.
It's amazing that you're part of it. You know, it's fantastic that you're able to volunteer and be part of that. You know, I think we've done very well as a country. It's, you know, it's a very British way of doing things, and it's good. There is a picture on your Twitter account, which is of you and
Her
Majesty.
Yeah, sorry,
can you tell me
that,
a bit about that
happened
one?
During my 2 years ago in 2019. The official invitation says the Master of the Household has received a Majesty's command to invite Mr. Ron Knight to a reception to be given at Windsor Castle by the Queen to mark the centenary of the National Council for Voluntary Organisations. This was on the 2nd of April 2019 at 6 p.m. I duly attended there with one other NHS volunteer. There were two of us who were from the NHS as volunteers. I was one, the other one was a young lady from up north. We were actually also both earmarked, a part of a small group, to have a personal introduction and chat with the Queen. And when my turn came, she asked me what my job was, volunteering, and I explained and said how the patients come very terrified and they don't like it. I also mentioned that at that time I was well aware that Prince Harry was our Captain General. And obviously I was wearing the Royal Marine tie and I knew she would notice it. I found a small lady in stature, but very clear, penetrating eyes. And you could see she took in every word you said. What I said enough, apparently, to make her give a nice smile. And the palace decided later that day that they would use that picture on their Instagram feed of Her Majesty at this particular event. So it's the Queen. She's looking towards and talking to me, but of course the camera has taken her in full facial because she has got given a very nice, warm smile.
It's a very nice picture. I noticed it straight away. I just want to thank you. You know, it's been really interesting talking to you. I'm sure that people will be interested in listening to your story. And the two real sort of experiences you had, you know, there's two great naval ships that are still with us, of course, in owned by the nation, and you're able to visit, and two operations that were, you know, almost forgotten but really important. You know, Korea involves so many people, and so many lives were lost, and so much happened there, but people don't know about it anymore. You know, they only know about the Second War of Falklands. And of course, Malaya, you know, people forgotten that we were in Malaya and that sort of withdrawal from empire, that fighting of the communism, you know, the communist sort of expansion that led on to all those other things, Borneo and Vietnam and everything else. So really, really interesting talking to you. And I just want to say thanks very much for your time.
I hope it comes over as you want. I'm sure as time goes on, I think of lots of other little things, but one's memory... over the years, you build up so many things like that. You bring them all to front in the right sequence. There's one other little interesting thing.
Yeah.
You needn't recall it formally. Well, the surgeon I work with in the West Suffolk Hospital was a volunteer. From time to time, he goes to China to lecture on eye treatment and his particular skill.
Right.
And when he came back one day, he said,
Yes.
I was telling my Chinese host about you. He said,
Right.
He's gone over there as a friend, but he said, I was telling him about the job you do. Like with a volunteer, we can make this procedure a lot more easy and comfortable by relaxing the patient, etc., etc. But also, he said he spent his time abroad, either in Korea fighting Chinese or in Malaya fighting Chinese. So he particularly told me that because he won't say he was. He was being hosted by the Chinese, and he was saying somebody on his staff spent their service life trying to kill him.
Yeah. Well, I do hope, Ron, that we can share a pint one day and maybe a tot of rum to toast the Queen together. It's fantastic. Thanks. Well, look, let's catch up again. I'm sure you'll think of some more things, and maybe once I've got a few more podcasts out and we want to revisit, we could probably think of something else to
Yeah.
talk about. Because it'd be very
Okay,
nice to talk
Sam.
to you again.
Yep. Nice to chat with you. You're welcome.
So really, thanks very much, Ron. Lovely.
Well, thanks very much for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. Please do visit my website, royalmarineshistory.com, to see the ever-growing map. We now have over 600 pins marking our history across the great globe itself. Whilst you're there also, please take a moment to sign up to my monthly blog, ensure you don't miss another episode or indeed another great dit. Please stay safe wherever you are, and look after the person to your right. Take care.